to Todd. Much thanks to Eddie. We got to go. Goodbye.
Tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, usually a program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. This morning, another one of our annual programs. In this case, today being February 9th, our remembrance of the events of February 11th, 1977, making this the 25th was then called the WBAI crisis. Stay tuned. And this is WBAI in New York City. We will get to the main topic and thrust of the program in just a little while. We have a guest this morning, our program director, Bernard White, and a central figure in the current issues that have been surrounding WBAI. And while my February 11th programs are center on that crisis, it seemed logical. And by the way, this is an idea. Inviting Bernard on was an idea submitted to me by a listener who I met at a function. And a great idea it was. To bring relevance around it, largely for me, because I have been so, I don't know, confused by issues of late. To have him here. So it should prove an interesting morning. But Bernard is about 10 minutes away from arriving here. You know, it's not enough that he's working here 60 hours a week. He consented to get up at 4 a.m. on his day off, in essence. Sigh. So we will spend a little time doing some other things. First of all, the music that you heard. Those of you who heard last week's program might have guessed. Little was I aware. Last week's program, I was talking about the legacy of James M. Barrie, and most specifically, his Peter Pan stories. And tying that around, a show that is currently running on Broadway, although it's not technically speaking a Broadway show. It is nevertheless at the New Victory Theater on 42nd Street and Broadway, called Peter and Wendy. And I had seen it 5 years ago and saw it again last Saturday night. And I was really pushing it, and let me tell you something, I was underselling it. It's wonderful. I did not realize there is actually a cast recording, and that is what you are hearing. We'll hear a little more of it in a few minutes, but this is the original music written and arranged by Johnny Cunningham, and I'm trying to remember the name of the woman singing. I have the liner notes here, but they're printed so artfully that I can't read them. The first voice that you hear is that of the only person whose voice, or I say, whose voices you hear throughout the program. She, in essence, is the narrator, but she plays Wendy and does the voice for everybody from Peter Pan to Captain Hook and so forth. And her name is Karen Kendall, and she is just magnificent. I don't think she's eligible for a Tony Award because it's not a proper run. The show only runs through February 24th, but if she were, she would have to win it hands down because it is just a brilliant performance. Again, the show is truly multicultural. You have the Celtic music. Smee is a Jamaican. The woman doing Wendy in all the voices is an African American. The puppets are Japanese. There are just so many cultures that are invoked in this. But it is magical theater, and it is a brilliant rendition, the only rendition of Peter Pan that I've seen that is really true to the James M. Barrie. I must say, though, I did not see the production of Peter and Wendy that was done about 3 months ago at Theater for the New City. But this is the one that I personally adhere to, and we'll hear a little more of that music in a little while. Coming up on this program over the next couple of months, next week, a recorded interview, recorded about 2.5 weeks ago, with Rudy Rucker, one of the fathers of cyberpunk, and a brilliant writer, mathematician, of higher math, and I interviewed him in his hotel room. Then he did a reading at the KGB bar, which we also recorded. So we'll be presenting those next week. In no particular order, let me tell you who will be coming on the program over the next couple of months beyond next week. They include Dr. Paul Levinson, who has a new novel out. This is a science fiction writer who has just published a mystery. And we will have Walter Mosley, a mystery writer who's just published a science fiction novel. And Mosley, if you don't know his work, well, then you have some good times ahead of you as you discover him. He's a brilliant writer and his science fiction, this is his second science fiction novel, is just dead on. Good, good, good stuff. Also, Deborah Raji, who was supposed to be here 2 weeks ago, will be here at the end of March. David Brin, one of the premier writers of science fiction, will be showing up in early March. So, a lot of good stuff ahead. We also have a backlog of recordings from the New York Review of Science Fiction reading series and other agendas. I'd like to find one show, and I may actually do a substitution next week. In one show, I'd like to read two short stories. One is the short story Imposter by Philip K. Dick, and the other one would be The Rollerball Murders by William Harrison. For those who are not aware that there is such a short story, the first movie was based on it, and this new and the first movie had some merit. It's going to be on TV tonight, by the way, for those who get Turner Classic Movies. For the current version, just completely disinterests me. But the short story is a great thing. I also might want to work in somewhere the short story Minority Report, another Philip K. Dick short story, which is to be released. To be a major motion picture. It's actually finished by now, but it stars Tom Cruise and Meryl Streep and is directed by Steven Spielberg and is also based on a Dick short story. This one promises to be more interesting and of higher quality than these previous adaptations of Philip K. Dick. Best adaptation I've ever seen of Philip K. Dick, by the way, was done by the same people who did this production of Peter and Wendy. The Mabu Mines Theater did a stage production of Flow My Tears, the Policeman Said, which I hope they will bring back. They seem to bring things back every few years, and the last time they did Flow My Tears, in New York anyway, was about 8 years ago. So, just for what it's worth, the second best Philip K. Dick adaptation ever is a movie that nobody has ever heard of called Barjo, B-A-R-J-O. It's a French film, a low-budget film, and just brilliant. It is not, strictly speaking, science fiction, but who cares? It's good stuff. At any rate, I think that covers the specific announcements I needed to make. And we will listen to some more selections from the album, Peter and Wendy. I don't know if the show is sold out yet. I know it was selling well before, and on Tuesday, got a very good review in the New York Times from Lawrence Van Gelder, which is probably helping to propel sales. And since it only runs through the 24th, and since tickets are relatively cheap, the most expensive ticket for this particular Broadway show is $30, and there are tickets available as low as $10. So I suspect it'll sell out, and I recommend it, that's all. So we'll hear a little bit more from that album, just some tunes at random, and Bernard gets here. He and I will start working on our coffee and bagels, and we will get going with our agenda for the morning. Stay tuned. Oh, yeah. There's no reason not to call in Pledge, by the way. You know the number, right?
Wendy cried, "If only I could go with you."
"Can you see? You can't fly."
And as Wendy waved farewell, Jane has waved farewell. And it's Jane's child now who waves from the window, enthralled to the breath of the night sky, where her child is flying, gay and innocent and heartless.
From the cast recording of the it's on Broadway. It's just not a Broadway show. Peter and Wendy, which we discussed at length last week, running at New Victory Theater. I don't care if you have kids or not. In fact, they recommend that this is for ages 12 and up. But as you can hear from the sound of the thing, this is not the Disney Peter Pan we are talking about. This is very much the original dark, dark version. I mean, as you could hear, that last line is, "And so it will be as long as children are gay and heartless." That right there, and the idea that two is the beginning of the end. It's a very dark, very dismal, and yet loving view of James M. Barrie's world. This is WBAI, New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf, on the air for 30 years and 3 weeks. And every year about February 11th, I do a program commemorating the crisis. That's what it was called for years. The capital T, WBAI crisis, all caps and pretty much all of that thing. And even as of 2 months ago, I knew that I was going to do it this year. But as of 2 months ago, I was also pretty sure that that would make this my last program. This is not the first time that I've done this show and thought it would be my last program. But as things turn out, this is probably the 1 year in which I can not have to worry about the internal political ramifications about talking about this time that, for some reason, a great many of the people who were involved then just do not want to talk about. And I knew at that time, I knew 25 years ago exactly what was going on. I knew who the demons were, and I knew who the angels were. And as time goes on, it gets more and more confusing. You know, there are changes in me, and there are thoughts and realizations about what it was. And frequently on these annual programs, we do a whole, well, you know, either a personal reminiscence or play one of the two documentaries, radio documentaries that were done about that time. There was also a film documentary that the only person I know who would know anything about that is a former producer named Paul McIsaac, because I saw that film up at Goddard College when he was he invited Margot Adler and Celeste Wesson and I up to teach radio at Goddard the summer of 77, and we saw the documentary at that time. It was quite interesting. But in brief, there was, in 1977, a revolution. The rumors were rampant that there was an entire other staff being hired to come in and take our place, and a whole new program schedule with a whole new format for WBAI being put into place. The rumors were then, as they have been before and since, that one of the station's licenses were to be sold. very likely ours, because we're the only of the five Pacifica stations, we're the only commercially licensed stations. The others are down further on the dial. We're at 99.5, and that is a valuable asset. And it came to pass that as people became aware of these things going on, they would go on the air and allude or directly talk about them. And one by one, they were taken off the air. The gag rule, as people refer to it now, was in the 60s at WBAI referred to as the Albertson memo. We had a station manager named Chris Albertson, who I think is some hotshot producer today. He produced some documentary. He produced Lady Day on Billie Holiday. And he, Albertson was our station manager, did a show called The Inside, which Steve Post later took over and called The Outside. And Albertson was really PO'd at some political stuff going on in the station, went on the air lambasting people by name and the management and all that, and he was the first person fired under his own memo. And this was, as far as I know, the first gag rule implementation. There has, it comes and goes with the political stretchings of the radio station. But in 77, it got to the point where our chief engineer was told that if one specific person, Bob Fass, was to discuss programming changes on the air, the chief engineer was supposed to stand by at the remote control unit with his hand on it, and Fast started discussing stuff, take the station off the air. Well, the chief engineer was fired, Fast was fired, a fellow named Bill Monahan, Dolores Costello, who headed up the Third World Communications Vanguard, which at the time was pretty much the only African-American presence at WBAI, and that only got in here through demonstrations, and the local board of WBAI, people hear about the local board today in you know how essential it is and all that. In those days, it was the local board that voted and determined to take WBAI off the air to silence all producers so that these changes could not be discussed on the air. And it was a very bizarre vote. I don't remember the exact number, but it is noted that all the men voted to turn the station off the air and all the women voted to keep it on. And there was one abstention, the late Lex Hickson.
Ralph Engelman was the chair of the board.
That's correct. Yes, Ralph Engelman was chair of the board. The local board, and, you know, he was, as I say, Satan incarnate at that time. Mm-hmm. There could be no more evil person in the world. Now, to, you know, that's what I talk about as time goes on. My views change because it's quite clear now that Mr. Engelman is a complex, interesting person. And I don't really know that much about him now. All I know is that my clear view of that time, my knowing everything so perfectly, there has to be a deeper reality than my perception.
I know I've spoken to Ralph about that period. And there is an FCC law that says that the institution has, those folks who run the institution have to be in control of the air. And if they lose control of the air, it jeopardizes the license.
That is the statement that they issued at that time.
Right. And so he considered himself taking control of the air. And if it meant shutting the station down, then he would do that to maintain control. And his feeling was that he was saving the station from being sanctioned by the FCC.
Yeah. That is the position that they issued. We, the staff, and at that time, what was going on then was extremely different than what was going on now, mm-hmm. although I think, as I keep trying to say I think that what's going on now are still reverberations of that time. But the big difference was is that it was clearly staff versus management. It was the program director, the station manager, the local and the national board versus us. That was the delineation. There was nobody on staff siding on the other side.
I think what happens at each of these junctures where we reach a crisis is that what's happening inside is pretty much a reflection of what's happening outside.
Without question.
At that time, you had Pablo Yoruba Guzman. I wasn't here, but I was a listener at that time, and I remember him playing a Eddie Palmieri record one day that I really liked. And then at the end of it, he said that you're going to be hearing more of that pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty soon you're going to be hearing a lot of salsa. We're going to play a lot of salsa. And I thought to myself at that time, not knowing what was going on, that was a bizarre statement to make. And I know that it kind of shook me, so that the people here at the radio station, I imagine that it really shook them, because hearing more salsa was one thing, but saying that you're going to hear a lot of it, knowing that there's a finite number of hours, meant that you were going to fundamentally change the radio station. And I know that that scared people. There was this talk, as Hinckley writes, about inner city broadcast, which was emerging at that time. And that I also had heard the rumor about the possibility of inner city broadcasting buying the radio station and turning it into a salsa station. And I would imagine that it was used by Pablo at that time as a way of frightening the people that were here. I'm not sure whether inner city was ready to buy another radio station.
We're not clear on that. We believed it, certainly.
Well, and part
but in retrospect, it's not a sure thing. But they were involved.
Yeah. Well, what
the news
that
director
believe,
of Inner City Broadcasting,
David Lantel, was on the board.
Was on the board.
And that's what I think fed that belief.
Yes, that's exactly what fed
rumors it. Rumors just, you know, there's a little machine somewhere in the AI that just spits out rumors. And we can't find the machine, but the rumors keep spitting out.
Yeah.
And
well, at that time, now they're rumors and probably inaccurate. Then they were sheer fact.
I see what you mean.
I hope everybody listening hears me waggling my fingers when I say sheer fact, okay?
Well, you know, also, you know, at that time, too, you had Dolores Costello, and I think Pepsi Charles was a part of it, the Third World Group, which was in society. What was happening, too, concurrent with that, is that African-Americans had leapt into the mainstream media, too. They were pushing forward to get some presence there.
And Dolores only came in by staging a demonstration. In those days, we owned a church, mm-hmm. a sanctuary of the church.
Yeah,
and she came in and staged, and she staged a peaceful demonstration, refusing to leave until she got heard
mm-hmm.
by people. And mm-hmm. that is the only way that she got a foothold on the air in those days.
Well, most of the
charges at the station was absolutely white, are not unfounded.
Yeah. Most of the folks who made it into media got into media because of one demonstration or the other. Because in the 60s and leading into this early 70s, there were, you know, the riots in the street. And it was just unsafe for white reporters to go into these areas. So they began to hire black reporters to go in and report back what was happening. So that BAI was in a similar situation where there were only white producers, white on-air personalities.
White board.
White
with
board.
With the exception of David Lampel.
Right. And so therefore black folks began to demonstrate, led by Dolores Costello, to get in and to have a presence at this community station.
Yeah.
Yeah. But looking at the crisis...
Yes, she did a wonderful job, I thought. She
mm-hmm.
She became... There are people that naysayed her and all, and she was one of the first people barred from the air in that era before the whole station was turned off the
mm-hmm.
air. And then the charges said, well, you've got no black people on the air. And the answer was, well, yeah, you just banned them all. Was the way that we were looking at it at the time. The entire Third World Communications Vanguard, which had about 18 hours a week of programming, a lot of midnight to five slots and key programs, both music and political talk and arts programs across the board, were all taken off the air.
Yeah. Well, at that time, too, and even today, what a community radio station does is give voice to people from the community. And there are times when, you know, those voices aren't necessarily, don't fit the mold. They don't fit the, you know, the sound of people coming to the ear talking on FM radio. But those voices have statements to make. They also help to facilitate getting other voices from the community to come in and to tell their story. So I was one who was never really, well, I do think that people have to be understood when they're speaking, but if they split an infinitive here or there, or their verb and subjects are at war, it's sometimes that you still can get the message out, and the message is, to me, was the most important thing. Now, leading into this crisis here, it is also reflective of what was happening in society, that we had an attempt to corporatize Pacifica. And when I say corporatize, there were individuals who had gotten onto the board, primarily from what made this strange is that these people were basically from the black community.
Let's just give a little connectivity on how the 77 thing sort of closed,
all right,
which was that after a standoff of 7 weeks that we were off the air, there was a intervention. Some of members of our steering committee brought Judge Oliver Sutton into the station.
That's Percy Sutton's brother?
That is Percy and Jack Sutton's brother. Jack Sutton being then the owner of Inner City Broadcasting, Percy Sutton being the borough president of Manhattan, who was currently assessing WBAI for property taxes. Never mind the fact that we were a 501c3. Our perception was that if the things went along well with Inner City Broadcasting, then those property tax issues would be taken away. However, when Judge Oliver Sutton sat over the case, he found nothing wrong with it, with the doings of either of his two brothers. But one way or the other, when Judge Oliver Sutton came in, there had been some arrests made during our takeover of the transmitter and various things going on, and he basically put those issues to rest. We returned to the air with the very people that we had been fighting. The board, the local board, resigned en masse. But we continued on the air with our station manager and our program director. Station manager was Anna Kosov, who, interestingly now, if this is correct, I was told this, but I believe she is now the producer of a show done by Marty Goldenson, who was on the union steering committee in 77. They were facing off at that time. Now they work together, if this is true. I'm not sure where Yoruba is nowadays.
I think he was last seen on Fox.
Yeah, he was on 4, then he was on 5. He was in the Daily News regularly. David Hinckley basically has his job.
Which is unique, because generally when black producers left, they wound up getting other jobs. Most of the white producers were able to continue to do radio somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyhow, we came back on the air in what one would call a very uneasy alliance. Shows like what we are doing at this moment, talking about that situation, were ubiquitous for a year and a half, minimum. I still get mail from a few listeners. Many other listeners know the names of those listeners and hear their voices still.
Good morning, John.
Yeah, hey. A brilliant man. A very interesting and brilliant man. I'll give him that.
Okay.
And they introduced the word putsch to my vocabulary. And things moved along from there, and the issues that, as you put, were societal issues that were being echoed in WBAI were never resolved, and I don't think they were really resolved in society. For me, the 77 crisis was a life-turning and life-defining point. At that point, I was literally living at the radio station. My bed, my clothes, my books, everything was at the church. And I'd spent a lot of time in the facility that we moved to. We moved to under suspicious circumstances with the sale of the church and all that, and the taxes being assessed against a 501c3, which I still don't understand. And the church, multi-million-dollar property that gets, it's now an apartment building, getting I don't know how much in rent a month, was sold for $475,000. Very unusual. And the as we came back to the air, things started normalizing. The one criticism that I would make is that what never really returned was a full-fledged arts program. We started losing arts. We started the music department and the drama and literature department were merged into one. And where I would say before 77, we were probably, what, about 60% arts and the rest free-form news and public affairs programming. And that is a very different ratio today. And I have supposed, and I don't know that this is accurate, but it is a charge I like to make, if only for conversation purposes, that a lot of what I see going on among people are what I call the artists versus the politicians. BAI became extremely politicized, as the 80s. On the left, we're extremely politicized.
Well, what I think happened is, and I see that happening today, and I'm not really talking negatively about the person in charge of the arts department now.
I'm not referring to that at all.
You power can seize nothing without a demand. For instance, I have been asking people here, for the last 2 years, well, interrupted by a year, for
a slight pause.
Yeah, to put together some plays. I've asked Max. I've asked what's his name, who's just doing a program here, Fred Giobol. I've asked Anthony Sloan. I said, why don't you put together some plays so we can get back into producing these plays? Because what happens is when people get involved, then it stimulates other ideas. So these are the main people to, I mean, Fred was in a play off Broadway. Max was always involved in putting some plays together. But
I'm still the only one here, including Rosenberg, who ever won a Tony Award, though.
Okay. But people do not, they just don't put those plays together again. I've even speaking of Rosenberg, I spoke to him about take a look at the arts, at the community here in New York. We have a lot of actors, unemployed actors, who can keep their, keep their craft alive by putting together some plays here, professionally done, on the air.
Okay, here's a political observation. Given the program directors that we have had since, let's say 1980, I dare say you are unique in trying to actually foster that.
Well, I don't know, because Samori Marksman was even acting in some of the plays.
Absolutely. We put him on Poisoned Arts.
Right, he was on Poisoned Arts.
But he didn't, when I say foster it, he wasn't asking for it. I mean, there was a time when Samori took this program off the air with the statement that he told me I could quote, and I often quote it, when you are doing arts, you are not taking care of business. And this is his first tenure as program director, and he ate those words gladly. He came on the program and discussed that whole thing. I tell the story every so often. What I did was I went out and I got a few. I said, well, what about 1984 and Brave New World and this and that? And he said, well, that's not science fiction, that's literature. And that's what set me off. So I got him some books by Ursula K. Le Guin and a couple of other choice people, very political books. And there were basically no black writers on the scene in science fiction at that time, unlike now, with, you know, the exception of Samuel R. Delaney. And Samori read one book, and the show was back on.
You know,
but that was a statement that he had made.
I mean, but he also believed that art was political, and that you know you could do art and still maintain a and still be political. It just wasn't all frivolous. That you could do political art too. I mean, Animal Farm, which Anthony did a play on, was, you know, a very, very important play. I think that you can use these.
But see, that's
forms.
Where he said that wasn't art, that was literature. That was that wasn't science fiction, that was literature.
Yeah.
My point is that science fiction is, in fact, the best forum for political thought in fiction, because you can posit your societies and manipulate them to make your points.
Sometimes it tends to be a bit escapist too, but you can raise some ideas under the rubric of being science fiction that are concretely happening today. But you know, back to what was happening here, because I haven't really told the story of how my perception of what was going
on here.
I was saying that. What had happened on the board is that there were these black conservatives that had come in to the national board, and that they came in with the same mindset as white conservatives, and their goal was to sell one of these radio stations, and to benefit personally from the sale of the radio station.
Taking the money
personally,
not for the good of Pacifica.
Pacifica would get some good out of it, according to what they believe. They believe that if they sold WBAI and KPFK, that they would, but especially WBAI because of the market that we're in.
Yeah.
That they would
market in the fact that we're a commercial license.
Right, we're right in the commercial band instead of the nonprofit community. We're at 99.5 FM, which is right in the middle. So it's a very, very expensive real estate. And that if they sold WBAI, they would get like $250 million. They would buy several other radio stations, move WBAI to some remote location on the dial, and that they would personally benefit from the sale. Because, you know, if you get 5% of $2 million. Mm-hmm. That's a nice little chunk.
Yeah.
And they began to structure the bylaws so that they could get that. John Murdoch, who worked on the bylaws, had a clause in there that said that the board members and their families could, being involved in the sale, get some kind of compensation from the sale.
The idea of selling the station, by the way, is something that I've heard here since the early to mid 70s, attending board meetings in those days. There was one fellow on the board, Ted Conant, who from 1973 always advocated this.
Well, it makes good financial sense. I mean, when you look at it on paper, if you take out all the people, all the emotion, all the attachment,
all the meaning,
all the meaning, it makes good dollar and cents.
The fact that it is denying the very basis of what Pacifica, and when I say Pacifica, I'm referring, the grand ideals presented by Lou Hill and cohorts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Somebody who very few people who work at Pacifica ever read.
Yeah, and by the way, if you want to read Lou Hill, you the listeners, www.ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF.com/listenersponsored.html.
Mm-hmm.
It's been up there for 3 years.
His essay on the theory of listener sponsored radio is, it's a must reading for anybody who comes to work at a Pacifica radio station, because it lays out just what this whole thing is all about, or should be about.
And it is relevant today.
Mm-hmm.
It is.